Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
And Brian Brushwood.
Yes, I'm live in studio. I'm in Justin's studio, sitting right next. I could poke him. I'm poking his shoulder.
That's a fact.
It's happening.
Mm-hmm. Here,
it's happening.
Is it tender? Is it tender? Yeah. Is it done? Is it ready?
No, it's rock hard. It's sculpted from marble.
Yeah. I mean, like a kind of a back alley, like, you know, it's more marble substitute, you know. It's marble that fell off the back of
it's not free
truck.
Trade proper.
No, it's mostly Play-Doh.
All right, gentlemen, I would like to say that at first CES that there was actually something that I'm not like, oh, look, a bigger, thinner TV. Wow, the future is cool.
Dude, this CES was all about the VR, right?
It's not what I'm talking about, but tell me what you're talking about.
Well, I don't know. It's like they were showing
off. I think I know what Andrew's excited about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Teledildonics?
No.
Oh.
I mean, aside from the burning fervor he's had for that for decades.
That's nothing new there, Brian.
Exactly. Okay, all right. Yeah. I saw a lot of...
And just know that can mean input, too. Okay, guys? Everybody listening?
They were showing the Vive, and they announced the price for the Oculus. What, $600?
Yeah, $599. It'll come out in March, I believe.
There's a photo for you.
Man, don't you look
I
cool.
Swear to God, VR, the VR revolution will come with a mandatory side dish of derp photos. Like, it is just amazing to see like how funny it is when other people wear virtual reality goggles. Look at, I mean, it's
the Palmer Luckey photo from, was it Time or Newsweek or whatever. It was the contempt that they had for one of our brilliant young innovators who's, you know, really is a guy that if you want to say anybody who sort of put the initiative there to make this jump forward, and there it is on the cover of Time. And, you know, Palmer's been busy working in the lab and maybe not as had as much time to do whatever workout techniques Zuckerberg and Google guys
He's
do.
He's another man who's made of Play-Doh and not marble, and he deserves to be able to be sculpted from whatever he wants. So the two things that came out of CES, aside from, of course, amazing breakthroughs in fridge technology, which we always see at CES. And
it's the Internet of Things, Justin.
Yeah, the idea that there are better and newer ways for you to buy a television was a lot of autonomous drone technology. You saw the new Segway, like technology.
Oh,
that
yeah,
gives you
the Segway becomes a freaking droid.
Yeah.
Like you step off the Segway and then it just becomes a BB-8 and follows you around.
But I believe what Andrew's talking about is another autonomous vehicle.
Uh oh.
Brian, did you see the company that made the Ghost drone, Chinese company, decided that they were going to scale things up a bit? They said, you know what? Carrying cameras is kind of cool. You know, you can do that. And maybe carrying 3D cameras is kind of cool and putting on your Oculus or whatever. And like, oh, man, it's almost like I'm up there and I can really see. You know what's cooler than that?
Nothing. I figured that's the pinnacle.
Nope.
Wrong, Brian. Wrong, what? Wrong, yeah. Wrong. Have you ever seen, I don't know, a person riding a drone?
No. Is this a thing? I did. Oh my God! I'm looking at video here. Human carrying drone debuts at CES. Now I did see somebody had put together a quadcopter that he rode on over some water, and he basically looked like the Green Goblin.
We had that. That was cool. The guy took like 20 of these things. We haven't seen this actually work with a human in it, but this is a legit company, a legit funded company in China. Their video is really endearing because they talk about like how many of their friends died in aircraft accidents. And so this thing's got something like 8 spinning rotors, and their goal is a drone you hop into, shut the door, press a button on the screen, tell it where you want to go, and then sit back, and it flies you there.
So, okay.
So now when all we've done is argue on this show about when we are going to have driverless cars, but maybe the answer, Brian, is where we're going,
we don't need
roads.
That's right. That's right. That's wonderful, because these would be, I assume, electric vehicles, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so I guess green energy, if that matters to you. Super efficient. We've talked before about how the pace of technology is getting faster and faster, and science is advancing faster and faster, largely because it's so much quicker to get things done. We talked about how in the 19th century, you know, there's stories of people going out to the Galapagos to go collect their samples, and then their boat sinks. And it's like, that's a whole year down the drain just to go get stuff to do science and stuff. The idea that all of a sudden we can enter a place where you would Uber, I assume there would be fleets of these. You would just call up one of these to get you there, and it would very directly, you'd have no traffic. You wouldn't have to worry about human error. You'd have skyways, lanes that the computers would adhere to. This is phenomenal.
Now, here's the caveats are that it holds one. We have not seen this thing actually fly with a person. Two, it only holds one person, has a max weight limit of 220 pounds. It's got a range of like 23 minutes of flight time, which I think is like a 10-mile range or something to that effect. And this is pointed out by some of the tech journals, like, well, you know, what's the practicality of that? Like, yeah, let's look at the practicality of a Stanley steamer in 1899. Like, yeah. Well, you know, this thing, shut up. And they'd be like, well, those, you know, the blades are right at the ankle height. Like, yeah, too bad we don't have technology that can tell when people are near. And it's like, shut up.
Like, see, this is interesting because I haven't heard any of this backlash against it. And I certainly don't understand
it. You know, the skepticism comes in. I think it would have been a different story if in that video they had actually put a person in the thing and it had flown them some degree of.
I don't know if they'll ever have a working product. And my point is like, yeah, 220. Yeah, that's a limit. But this is the version alpha. This is where it starts. Each version gets bigger and better. And that's, you know, the point that people kind of, they look at these things and go, nope, fail. No, apparently, and we, you know, the company said, hey, we can put a person in an electric vehicle and fly them through the air, which we've seen hobbyists do that. Now there's a company that says, yeah, we want to put people in electric vehicles that vertically take off and land, and we're bitching about this?
Yeah, no, that's kind of crazy. Although, the FAA has been very, very weird about drone regulation. You know, this is something that I almost wonder whether or not this is a easier solution than what the autonomous cars are facing with regulatory issues, you know, to get them on the roads.
I mean, really, the biggest issue you're going to have to deal with, and it's the same thing that, the company that may or may not be kind of scamish, Mahler Sky Car, has been promising flying cars for, you know, four decades, I guess, really. But the biggest hurdle that they have to deal with is the noise regulations. And so it's like the deciding where these things go, because they will be loud, I'm sure. Is going to be the biggest problem.
Elon Musk said in a press conference that he made the comment like, oh yeah, flying car, trivial, easy. It's just, oh yeah, I can do that between breakfast and lunch. If I cancel a couple meetings, I could solve this problem, but they're too noisy. And then he's like, next. So and that's the thing, that when they've announced the Segway, you had like, oh, cities could be redesigned around it and all this sort of stuff. And then you see it and like, maybe not. But with a practical flying car in certain places, that you see these things, let's say in Vegas, on the Vegas Strip and other places, you're like, oh, you know, you could have lanes and zones. And there is technology that is in development stage of how to make these things much more quiet.
Yeah.
And that's going to be – and there's a lot of military stuff out there that once it becomes consumer grade, is we might be able to minimize the sound of these things considerably. I want to throw out a conspiracy theory for you, though, for self-driving cars.
I don't know if this is the proper venue for conspiracy theories.
I'm in. Let's go.
You know who I think is going to have – we were surprised and shocked by the California decision about self-driving cars, saying that they told Google, no, you cannot assume liability for this. Every person that gets into it, their individual insurance has to be responsible for it. Two, not only will we not let unlicensed people in these vehicles, anybody who gets into one, who gets behind the wheel of one, has to have an extra special license, which was several steps in the opposite direction. We've talked before about the idea that, well, you know who's going to want this and love this will be the insurance companies. But may that be the opposite of the case? Because can you imagine a situation where we have really awesome electric cars that, like, never crash? What's the purpose of insurance?
Insurance companies don't love cutting checks, right? So they would still exist because, you know, people, for example, take airlines, right? Flying is far and away the safest way to get from point A to point B, yet people still buy insurance.
That market has plummeted. It's almost non-existent now compared to where it was when you had more frequent crashes.
Sure. But is your point that they want there to be more fatalities
Their point is that, you know, his point is in a world where there are less to negligible,
virtually no, yeah,
accidents, will we see a pushback for, like, you know, right now it's mandatory to have insurance. Like, you got to have insurance to be on the road.
Part of my and I don't know enough to know. This is just a guy. Oh, I wonder this, and I don't know enough to know. I'm not making any statement or claim.
We hear when you. You're just asking questions.
Just a guy asking questions. That's all. Is it mustard on my shirt? Is when they pushed back, Google said, we will assume liability. And then California said, no, you can't. And you look at that and you say, well, who stands to lose the most? Well, because Google's a very big company, and Google can essentially write their own policy. They are like, well, we can underwrite our own policy for this. Where insurance companies are in a position like, nah, we like the idea of selling 20 million individual, you know, car policies in California. And, you know, because that works, you know, insurance works on percentages. It works on percentages. You know, do they like cutting checks? No, but they're happy if, like, oh, 6% of every pay in whatever goes in and we make our margin, they like that margin. When that margin declines and you don't need that, then it's a market. And we've seen them do. You know, I've heard conspiracy theory stuff, like how they were the ones behind getting rid of helmet laws because it was cheaper to have a fatality than it was to have somebody who had to provide, you know, support for the rest of their life as they were quadriplegic. Yeah. Don't know if that's true. And I just assume every business, every market tries to maximize the environment in which it functions. They don't want to get rid of the problem they're paid to solve.
Yeah. I think you're right in that this incentives are kind of sideways. Whether or not it's an actionable situation, I don't know. Whether it's like the incentives are so great that they would actually, I don't know.
Well, again, and I think that we're going to see they're going to encourage a lot of, like, safety features stuff. But, like, we have in the state of Florida, you can't go to a third party and buy solar panels for your house and plug it into the grid because FPL made a deal with the state that says, no, everything has to be bought from the state utility.
Hmm.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, oh, wait. And it's like, and it's that because the thing they don't want is a state that gets a lot of sunshine and having a lot of third parties going in there. And somebody asked me, like, why is FPL buying solar, you know, stuff in California or building solar? Well, because it's, you know, it's the way in which they play into the system. And again, I'm not an anti-capitalist here by any stretch of the imagination, but we talk a lot about incentives. Where is somebody's incentive?
Yeah. I'm in. I'll subscribe to your newsletter. I think that this is we are seeing a conspiracy by the big auto insurance.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. So here's my question:
Is there one of them? You getting a kickback?
I'm not saying that I'm not. I'm just, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's my question:
Lift your shirt and show you the Geico tattoo.
This decision in California can't stay, right? I mean, 30 years from now,
will not stand, man.
30 years from now, are you telling me that is as outrageous to me as the fact that, you know, New Jersey and Oregon are two states where it's against the law for you to pump your own gas? You still have to have somebody, you know, fill your tank for you because of reasons, I guess.
Yeah, that's a thing there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I just undid my own argument. I was saying that I can't stick around, but clearly those artifacts have.
We I've thrown out the idea that we have a moneyed interest that could have an interest in saying, well, we're happy with certain safety features, but we don't like this idea of you not owning a car, needing insurance or whatever, because that totally undermines our market. We would rather the thing that like, oh, and we'll give you a policy for if you want to get into an electric car that's going to, anytime there's an explosion, anytime there's any sort of mishap, you know, we have an opportunity for a lobby to go in there and say, yeah, you know, we think this is great, but, you know, and that's my thought is that we see how these things become, take on momentum.
So from your perspective, if we are to believe that this is a nefarious plot by the insurance companies, what is the next step? Like, what are we on the lookout for?
I think that one is seeing, I'd love to find out who the California policy, so many of these state legislative, these policies, so many of these bills are written by external lobbyists. They're written by somebody who often somebody paid for by another company comes in and says, we'll write this for you. We'll give it to your office. And then, you know, you approve it and like that. I like to find out more. And Google's not a shrinking violet company in many ways. Neither is Uber. And I think that if there is something to it, we're certainly going to hear about it. And again, it could be conspiracy theory, and I mean, but it's just a thing that I'm like, man, like that just made no sense. Particularly the assumption of liability, which is just a critical point to make this sort of make self-driving ride shares functional, is the idea that you get in, you get out, you as a person just pay for the ride. You don't have to pay for anything else. Like, you know, imagine if you had to pay for special Uber insurance outside of or whatever just to be able to ride in one of those things. These would kill it, and I probably shouldn't even have said that out loud because now there's going to be somebody.
Now you've ruined
you
it.
You did it. You wished it into existence.
Oh, man. All right. Well,
okay, so let's talk real quick about this autonomous drone moving. You're moving one body. You're able to get very, very quickly. There is no gridlock. There is no traffic. You practically teleport from one point to another. What is the market for this? I assume – like, all I could think of is basically get from downtown to the airport in 7 minutes. And that alone might be worth $100 a ride.
I think that as you expand the capacity of this, and coincidentally, we're entering an age of super cheap energy, and it's not the way that people sort of wanted. Like, there's talk that we may get $1 a gallon gas.
Yeah, which is the weird part. Like, isn't that a weird unintended consequence of more solar and wind power is that all of a sudden the demand for gas goes down, and so as
that
a result, gas becomes super cheap.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with solar and wind. That is, it's fracking and it's natural gas.
Yes, but
well, and it's OPEC trying to
just not shutting off the spigot.
Well, yeah, because they're trying to drive the price down. Fracking.
They're trying to put those out of business. You know, the ones that they're competing. But yeah, eventually. But yeah, Brian. Yeah, actually, to your point is like as we solar and we get those Moore's law returns and we have more solar and have the absolutely right. It's going to be a point where we're just going to use rocket. You're just going to use it for rocket fuel. That's my hope.
Sure. But I guess my whole point is that that for those who are motivated by environmental concerns, you want to push alternative forms of energy, but the result of that will be that demand for gas will go down, which means it'll become cheaper, which means it will incentivize people to please choose gas because it's the cheap alternative.
Yeah. So to your question about if we have these self-flying cars, and they're quiet enough to let them take off from a parking lot in your super, you know, and I think you'll have little landing, you know, the idea there, it's not everybody owns one, if it's an idea that it's a ride share mentality, then yeah, it makes it, you put a little landing pad here and there, and you start thinking like, oh, like is Uber might get in on this, guys.
In fact, that's the only way I see this happening. I think early on you'll get the super wealthy, kind of similar to Tesla adoption of electric cars. It'll be a status thing to own one of these. You take it out, two or three times a month and show off your friends. But Uber will own a fleet of these, and it will be all of a sudden those helipads on the top of buildings will become prime territory because that's,
well, I think you'll see the idea of putting helipads on top of supermarkets and places, and the idea of like of just, you know, the all the places you've never had one before. But they're like, oh, we'll put one here, we'll put one here at the end of the block, you know, wherever you can go put one. And I think I don't know how close that future is, not from a technical point of view, but just the way things work. But I think we're going to get the flying cars.
I kind of wonder whether or not, this isn't a real alternative for city living, you know, that like, okay, well, I don't want to own a car because this thing can kind of do whatever I want. Like, you know, in an era of, I need to go to Home Depot, I can just pay for somebody on, you know, TaskRabbit or something to like buy it and bring it. You know, I don't need a car for that necessarily. You don't really need a car for moving stuff. I just kind of need to get from point A to point B. I wonder if this will ever be any cheaper than just owning a car.
I'm going to say, yeah, I'm going to say the very idea of car ownership is going to get increasingly, not silly, but maybe anachronistic. I think for most people, just the, maybe there'll be the equivalent of timeshares in an Uber fleet, where it's like, you know, you pay a certain membership fee and you just know that you can get, you will reliably be able to get from point A to point B.
Yeah, I think for some people, I think a lot of people love owning. To me, it's a box that takes you from point A to point B.
Right.
For people who it's, you know, who like that, you know, for the fans of Fast and the Furious, it's something more.
So I got a question.
People who live their lives a quarter mile at a time.
I was thinking about drones in general. And in fact, just today when I went to the park, it was adorable. Dude was flying his
crying.
Drone. I was crying.
Just
was
like,
crying.
Oh man, I listened to a podcast and I was just so sad. I started crying.
All right. I was thinking right now, you know, drones are novel and we're hand piloting and stuff. How far off, given how cheap and exciting drone technology is, and I don't entirely know what the purpose of this would be, but it seems to me like any minute we should be able to buy a box that would have a swarm of 10 mini drones that can do coordinated activities, you know, or, you know, whether it's, you know, I don't know, spelling stuff out in the sky or doing choreographed moves and all that stuff. It seems like, I don't know, there's something very, very cool about a swarm of mini drones. And I'm surprised I haven't really seen a lot with that.
We've seen in the lab, seen it really cool. There's been people who've done some cool stuff, like using them to spell out stuff in the sky. We've seen in the lab where they've used them to build bridges, like string bridges across a chasm. We've seen a lot of really cool precision stuff in laboratory that's terrifying, utterly terrifying, because they behave intelligently in ways that are frightening, and you realize if they wanted to kill you, you would be dead. I think that the answer comes into is you need a certain fidelity when it comes to positional tracking, and I think that that's just it's a technology question. And like the same thing with VR is that people were upset about that these VR goggles cost, you know, the Oculus cost, the Rift cost $600. And the reason it costs $600 is if you want to have that high density OLED display and those drivers and that stuff, that's what it costs this year. Next year, it'll cost $300. But people think Moore's Law or these things are debatable or whatever. And well, they should do this. I wish my iPhone was thinner or whatever. Like, no, it can't be. Physically can't be right now and do the things you want because that's where the technology is. But we have this predictable pace of this. With drone tech, you have microprocessor companies that are developing specific chips just for that, onboard gyroscopes, all these other little tech to make it easier, better positional stuff. So yeah, in a year, 2 years, that'll be a thing because that's the march of technology.
Yeah, even as I was suggesting it occurred to me, like, I just don't know what the tangible benefit is that will create a market demand for more people to do that. I think we'll see it just as a, you know, we'll see art projects and demos and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that you're going to see drones are our real first exposure to wide-scale robotics because they do something better than something walking or rolling around on the ground right now can do. And each generation of drone gets smarter and smarter as being able to track and follow and do other stuff. And then you're seeing applications that, like, well, what are practical applications? And you're starting to see that in industry where, oh, places where we don't want to send people, but we want to string cables, or we want to do this and that. And I don't, yeah, a swarm would be kind of cool, but it would also be terrifying.
Dude, you want to know what else is terrifying? Everybody who goes to patreon.com/weirdthing.
Wait a minute. They're terrifying?
No, it's terrifying how much their support has done for us. Sometimes when I think about it, I get chills down my spine.
I'll tell you what, man. I think about the fact that it used to be that this was a side gig for all of us. We would do it, and sometimes we went months at a time where we just didn't bother to do weird things. How crazy was that? Those days are over, my friend.
Indeed. Patreon.com/weirdthings is your one-stop shop to make sure that you can support this show. Should you find it valuable to your life, you can give us value by way of money. It's a fun thing for all.
I'll tell you what. If we were physically there hanging out with you telling this story, would you give each of us one U.S. quarter? I think you would.
If we were physically there crying.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you give one quarter to every adult not crying on a park bench?
I'm crying tears of joy because this is amazing. Patreon.com/weirdthings. In all honesty, thank you guys so much. It's really great.
Yeah, man. Let's get up over 500 patrons. Let's make that happen.
Yeah. 500.
Mm.
Gentlemen, we're going to play a game.
Yes. Oh, good. I like games.
It's called What Is This? And Bryce is going to queue up a photo for you, and you're going to look at it, and you're going to tell me what it is and what's important about it.
Okay. I think I might know.
Really?
No, I don't know. It's 3D printed, right? First of all, for radio listeners, we're looking at some kind of gray, looks like an assembly of geometric, a lot of triangles. It looks like a truss system, and it looks like a bunch of rocket engines, five of them pointing up, five of them pointing down. And in the center, it looks like a tiny kind of like a miniature concert venue.
Yeah, it looks like, yeah, a theater in the round.
Yeah.
Although that also there's a little a raised point there that kind of looks like it would snap into something. I feel like that's something that it would hook in.
If I was going to guess, I would say this is a mock-up of some kind of rocket-based flying drone.
There's not a whole lot of elaboration here, but it is a part of a rocket. It is a 3D printed part of a rocket. What makes this special?
I assume that Elon Musk had something to do with it.
No, wrong, incorrect, false.
Was this printed on the International Space Station?
False, incorrect.
Damn.
Was it on the rocket that came back down?
Oh, no. You know what? I got a good idea from the chat room. Somebody says this is made of ceramics, which I seem to remember having read something about, where it's like the ability to 3D print ceramics is huge because ceramics deal with high temperature situations much, much better.
No, false. Damn. Incorrect.
So wait, both of our things were false?
Yeah, is the news story that I'm remembering false, but that's not what this is?
It's not what this is.
Okay, all right.
And you're just false and incorrect in general.
I mean, that's a safe bet just all the time.
It's made of iron and nickel.
It's made of iron and nickel. Are those rocket engines or something?
Just some part or something, you know. I mean, it could be some sort of thing. But the more important is what it's made from.
Okay. Iron and nickel, huh?
All right, you ready for your big clue?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're looking at it.
Is it made from a meteorite?
Bing bing, there you go. What?
Oh, that's amazing.
So Planetary Resources, the company is started by Peter Diamandis, who's the author of
Bold and Abundance.
Yeah, I created a new book for him there. So he has a company that what they want to do is they want to put a bunch of satellites into space with telescopes and aim them at meteors and asteroids to see if there might be ones that are very mineral rich. And part of what they wanted to show is to how you could build things in space. They took a meteorite found on Earth, ground that thing down into a powder, and they put it into one of those laser printers that we've seen that basically took the powder and then it created a rocket. Now, it's made of iron. They say, listen, this is crude. This is not high tech. This is the, quote, iron age of this stuff. But they took an object, the same kind of thing you would find flying around in space, and they made a part for a spaceship out of it.
That is unbelievably huge. This is the moment that all of a sudden, you know, real-time strategy games become possible in space, where it's like you can – if you played Warcraft 3, then you know what you got to do is all you need is a mine and the ability to send dudes to harvest wood and build and use the buildings to build more buildings. And then, you know, we could do that in space now. We could set up robots to harvest materials to make more robots, to make more robots.
Well, and this is – I mean, they have said – Planetary Resources has said that the trillionaires of our age will come from space mining. That if you look at how expensive iron and nickel are, I mean, like nickel mines, some of the most rich people on the planet are owners of nickel mines. So that's huge.
Here's the way to understand why space mining could be potentially big and why Planetary Resources wants to start aiming their telescopes out there to find out what's there. On Earth, to find stuff, we got to dig into the crust and find this. And the heavier minerals, the heavier metals, and have probably sunk down further deeper. And that's because as our planet was still this liquid ball, heavier stuff, the denser stuff went towards the bottom, and that makes it rare. Now, the asteroid belt is the remnants of a planet. There's only maybe like 0.1% of whatever that planet was is left there. But there's some speculation. But yeah, because that really was never formed into a planet, actually. Never formed. It was that disk that started to coalesce and the material started to come together, but it never reached planetary structure. So it never formed that big ball where all the things would sink there. You might have meteors that are big chunks of solid metal that you're not trying to sort through a lot of other materials to get to, that it's just like, hell, wow, you know, here's 100,000 pounds of nickel, or here's maybe 100,000 pounds of, you know, or 2 tons of platinum or whatever. We don't know. We just know that all the stuff that's on Earth, it wasn't made in Earth, wasn't made by little, you know, dwarves underneath, you know, the mountains. It was stuff that was formed in stellar explosions that just sort of drifts around and starts to form into rocks and other shapes. And so there's more gold out there. There's probably more gold and platinum and other materials drifting around there in space within the periphery of our solar system than we've ever mined out of Earth.
Oh, easily. Easily, I would imagine. It's so crazy, too, when you start thinking in terms of, like, once you could start significant construction in space, you know, is the question, do you even bother to bring the material back to Earth, or just go out and build out of that material?
Well, it depends. If you think there's something that is scarce on Earth, then the answer is yes. There's some speculation, though, that it may never be really practical to try to build any sort of industrial base in space, because just about everything we need is actually on Earth. And, you know, if you're the Julian Simon crowd like we are, you kind of like point out that, like, yeah, we don't really run out of things. But having more of some things or making some things really, really cheap might be really kind of cool. And if you could use gold in a wider scale industrial application, that becomes pretty awesome. There are a lot of things that they settle into, their scarcity settles into the market in which they're used. But when we figured out how to make steel much, much cheaper, that was a big technological revolution. It was kind of like battery technology in the 19th century, was trying to figure out how to make cheaper, stronger steel. And once we did that, changed literally the landscape of the world and made possible subways, high-rises, airplanes, and everything. So much of the technology we have today was based upon just figuring out this one material and have it in abundance.
Carl says, you know, silver is a way better conductivity than copper, but it's just too expensive to use in wiring. If that changes, you know, then we can fundamentally see a different shifting.
Yeah, a lot of these applications besides just the ornamental value.
That is very, 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 very interesting. And so I guess what they wanted to do here was just sort of demonstrate the soup to nuts promise of this, of like, look, we can take this down and we can 3D print something today. And isn't that rad?
Yeah, it's to show that we can take those raw materials as they exist and make stuff. When we go to Mars, we go to the moon, we colonize asteroids, as we've talked about, 3D printing is going to be a very important part of that. And that's how you build up, that's how you rapidly build up an industrial base and have the things you need. And this was just sort of a proof of concept and to show that. And a lot of the future spacecraft might be things that we just make in space. And we, to talk about like, oh, what if we make stuff on the moon, kind of seemed like sort of a really ridiculous idea, because you look at, you take a car factory in Detroit and you look at where do all the tools come from, where do all the materials from, you look at all that base that you need to make these things is way more than just that building. But with 3D sure. printing, and if you have access to materials that can make a lot of different things, game changer.
Yeah, it's sort of intimidating to think, you know, 1,000-year perspectives on this stuff. When you think in terms like what happens when labor becomes infinite and free, what happens when materials become infinite and free, what happens when I guess at that point our goal becomes to just spread throughout the universe, or to study, or I mean I don't know. It's almost like once you enter the cheat code for the video game of human ambition, what entertains you at that point? Why do you bother to do anything?
But don't you think that we've always been saying that like, you know, at the point of like, well, I mean, as soon as we build boats and we can, you know, take our people and goods anywhere we want. I mean, what's the point? You know, like, you know, now we've totally transcended these elements that have bound us. Like,
well, and that's part of what, you know, I think all of us really liked about Pandora's Star is the idea that even in a post-singularity, post-abundant universe, that really humans do what humans do, which is have sex and fight. And that's all we wanted.
It was a world that, you know, beat death, right? Like, you know, like death is a painful thing, but it's not a permanent thing. And shocker, everybody was still, you know, had a whole lot of drama.
1,000-year grudges.
Literally. That's amazing.
I have one more news item to talk about briefly, and that is this Sunday,
mm-hmm.
our friends at SpaceX have announced they're going to try to land another booster.
Yawn. No, I'm sorry.
Well, this time, Brian, what they're going to do is they've tried barge landings before. Tried is the operative word. They're going to try a barge landing again, this time from Vandenberg. They're going to launch the Jason 3 satellite, which is a weather satellite. And the significance of a barge landing is it's not so much that, as we saw when they, you know, when they landed at Canaveral, people are like, whoa, was that safe? Or I have a friend on Facebook who's like, yeah, but you know, I guess they're probably just going to try to do the barges in the future because people are going to complain. I'm like, listen, if you live in a place goddamn called the Space Coast, shut your mouth, okay? Yeah. Right.
No, it's fine. Everyone, it's fine. It's Canaveral.
Yeah. So what the purpose of a barge landing is when you have a really heavy payload satellite, that booster has to go further out, has to go faster and further, and has to push that out there. And it doesn't have as much fuel left in the tank to come all the way back to the launch pad. So what you do then is you just put a barge. In this case, I think this one might be I don't know if this one's read the instructions or which of the robot drone ships it was named for, but right. It will be one of those, and it's going to be there waiting to let the booster land on it.
That's amazing. The first one was called Just Read the Instructions after the Starships and Ian M. Banks sci-fi novels, which I've only read one of them, but man, I really enjoyed it. Player of Games was great.
Yeah, Players of Game is the catch in the rye for like new nerds. It's basically you just see it pop up over and over again from like, oh, and my favorite, you know, book is Player of Games. So that'll be cool. So I'm going to go try to watch that landing in Vandenberg and going up with some friends the day before. And then that morning we're going to go see if we will see the rocket. We won't see the landing because it'll be out at sea, but we'll see the rocket go off, hopefully. And they're going to do a test fire tomorrow. So if all works right.
I don't think we ever got a chance to talk about. We talked about the landing of the first stage of that SpaceX rocket, but I don't think we talked about the news when Elon Musk tweeted that it's ready to fire again. Is there any chatter about when and how they will reuse that? Or
I assume they're going to reuse it. I think they're going to do a fire, like a test fire, to show that the engines work. Mm-hmm. But I think that he wants to put that into a museum. or display it.
No, it'll be this one. Like, if this one lands on the barge, then, like, you know, I think that now that it's not the first one, you know, you can start.
I guess the first one, yeah, it's like you do take that original Kitty Hawk plane and you hold on to it.
Yeah, he said fired again, but not the same. He's very careful with his words. I think it's so launched, but and it's interesting too because it's like the thing landed, and then you have people like, well, we haven't seen it take off again. Like, yeah, like, no, you're correct. We watched a booster land on Earth from launching something into orbit. Shut up.
Yeah. This is fantastic, though. If this just becomes the new normal where all rockets are saved for future use, I mean, that's...
How amazing is it that it just looks like landing, because it's so... We're watching this helicopter footage. Because we're so not used to it, it just looks like a rocket ship taking off in reverse.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, it just looks like rewinded footage of, like, meh, meh, like,
do you remember just, like, when they first showed Grasshopper, the first day that came out, first couple days, there are people like, this looks faked.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I'm sure, you know, I don't know. I mean, and far from it to be, you know, for us to wave our fingers as we had just unfurled our massive insurance conspiracy theory. But, you know, yeah, I don't know. I think you're bound to get, you know, that those kinds of yahoos saying that, like, oh, I think we'll get more of it. We'll get more of, like, well, I don't know. Have they really sent anything up?
Agreed.
Gentlemen, jump into picks.
Hey, man, I'm reading the book that you told me to read, Super Intelligence.
Mein Kampf? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the other book. Yeah,
yeah, no, it's I'm enjoying it. I press pause to get caught up on podcasts, but I'll certainly, everything I've heard so far, I will back your play on that. Super Intelligence has some awesome, scary, crazy scenarios. If you want to be paranoid, it's a good book to read.
I will tell you another book that you can read to go along with that, and it was made into a movie, and there's been talk that Will Smith is trying to make this into a movie again, and it was based upon a trilogy of novels by D.F. Jones, and it was probably one of the first... I would say one of the first really interesting forays into, well, what happens if we do build a super intelligent machine, and that is Colossus, which became the movie Colossus, the Forbin Project. And what it is there's this project, this government project, to build a super intelligent machine to take control of all of our nuclear weapons, because what could be better than that? Takes over, and next thing you know, it says, hey, the Russians, the Soviets have a supercomputer too. I want to talk to it. And they're like, nah, we don't think we're going to let you talk to it. He's like, well, you know, I've got all these missiles here. I think you should let me talk to it.
Yeah.
And then it takes over. And then what happens then? And then it's deep, because it just gets into the idea that it's not that it becomes self-aware and has its own agenda. It's just that it takes its role really seriously as a thing that Nick Bostrom talks a lot about on Superintelligence. Like, it's not just one scenario we need to worry about where it gets a mind of its own, an agenda of its own, where it says, he gets into ideas like, you know, you could ask a super intelligent machine a question like, oh, how would we do this? And it might say, you know, in order to come up with an answer for this, I need to create 1 million virtual people in my head that are fully sentient, and then run this scenario through. And then when I'm done, I'll just wipe it out. And he talks about mind crimes, the idea of being able to create artificial minds inside of itself that it could then erase. And it's like, yeah, it's, you know, he's
morality conundrum, right? Where it's like, is it unethical to create genuine intelligences and then slaughter them?
Well, Brian, it is unethical. Let's get that clear right now.
I don't know.
I do. Unethical. Next question.
Oh, all right.
I mean, the idea is, at what point of creation do you assume responsibility? That's the line, right? Like, because if we can say, okay, there is a point in which you are responsible for whatever happens, then murdering it is like the worst thing that you can do.
Yeah, but like, I mean, I play Grand Theft Auto, and I don't think twice about shooting all. And granted, these are very, very rudimentary artificial intelligent things. But if we're just dealing with a simulation of exponentially higher quality simulation of artificially intelligent individuals, does it suddenly become unethical to play Grand Theft Auto?
I think at some point that is the territory of philosophers and people trying to figure out at what point does that. It's why we have an abortion debate. You know, that is, you know, and the argument of potentiality versus something actually realization of itself, whatever. It's why there aren't any easy answers that we can all agree upon, because we don't know. For me, I describe things, there's self-awareness and there's agency. Those two things are not always the same. And there'd been studies that said, hey, you know, a computer can predict what you're going to do. Free will's an illusion. Well, free will's an illusion within a few microseconds. But when you talk about a slower, longer term thing, like, no, free will is real. And we've looked at those experiments and said, oh, no, actually, we're finding examples of where we're not able to. And part of it is like, yeah, of course we should be able to measure you. And there's no evolutionary advantage in many ways to contemplate stuff, is you just want to react and then maybe come up with a narrative afterwards, which fit a lot of the anti-free will lobby or, you know, that point of view. But we can't put you into a room and tell you to come up with a creative story and in any way predict what the hell you're going to come up with an hour later. We will never be able to do that because it's a combinatorial problem. There are things that can take place in your head that are pseudo-random that you will never figure out in the universe. And so anyhow,
I don't know that I don't know. This is a philosophic thing. We probably need somebody smarter than us to chime in on it. But I don't know that a lack of predictability necessarily means that free will is a real thing. Like, you can, let's say we agree, like, you'll not be able to predict it, but you're still a slave to your choices. If I'm offered a poop sandwich or an ice cream, no matter how many times you run that simulation, I am a slave to my preference of ice cream over poop. Yeah. And there really is no free will as I choose the ice cream.
Yeah, but I mean that gets into a very narrowly defined thing, and I look at it more as the idea of the creative solution to it is that, you know, come up with something original or some other original solution, or come up with something that make a series of choices, and that process to me, that process itself is what arrives to the concept of agency, et cetera. And we can say, like, nope, I found this part here. I'm like, yeah, but you put that, you can break down these parts. And you can say that it's like, you know, you get an emergent property that you cannot predict or whatever, and that whole emergent property is the phenomena, is my opinion. And it's not as and we found cases where it was super reductionist, and it's, you know, and I think that we're 99%, 99.9% running on auto mode, but I think that I think of the idea of slow agency and slow free will, where, hey, start here, start that dialogue in your head. And there will be random factors and other things that are to contribute to it, and you're going to come out with a different thing at the outset. We can say, well, yeah, but we can break it down reductionist-wise, and I don't think there's a magical thing, but for me, you know, the voices in my head seem real enough.
It's a good point.
Man, this got heavy.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you know that when there's like a 10-minute discussion where just and that's why we have an abortion debate is just glossed over. The thing
that's
heavy.
The least controversial part of the whole thing.
Just randomly thrown in. Like, anyway, so people disagree on abortion. Also, here's another 9 minutes of really substantive, amazing conversation. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
But Brian, your observation, though, it's something I think a lot about is like, well, at what point is it wrong to shut off the computer and to do that? And I think that, you know, and Justin put it, say, well, if you're creating self-aware intelligent beings, then you have to say, hey, there's a thing that we think is a thing, so it's probably not a good idea to do that. And it all comes down to probabilities. We don't get absolute answers. We get probabilistic answers.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess the thought is just, you know, when do we value it as life? You know, like when does it have –
when it sits on a park bench crying.
All right. What's your pick, Justin?
Brian crying on Lake Merritt, I have found myself.
By the way, if you want a context for that, listen to the latest episode of Radiolab about the creation of that dragon cancer. It's amazing.
So Brian weeping just uncontrollably on Lake Merritt. The same
Lake
Merritt.
Globs of snot rolling down his nose too.
Just a blubbering mess. And
it was really embarrassing when somebody handed me a dollar too. And yeah, I was like, no, I'm fine.
It was a homeless dude giving you the dollar.
You know, children like, mommy, why is the man crying? Like, you know. Anyway, that same Lake Merritt, I've been trying to make a habit of running and walking around, and so I'm back to listening to audiobooks. And David Halberstam, who was one of the great nonfiction writers of our time, his classic book, The Best and the Brightest, about Vietnam, is what I'm listening to now. It is extraordinary. It is exceptional. And it is one of those things, as we get into a very politically charged season, you kind of realize that, like, things change a lot. Like, what we assume to be standard ways that, you know, political parties operate, you know, are they've rapidly, you know, not rapidly, it's just slow but surely, like, things change. And what you kind of remember, this is written in this era, you know, is that, you know, the Vietnam War was conceived and fought under Democratic leadership, and nobody has any reason to mention that, you know, in our modern system, you know, because the Democrats don't want to say, like, hey, we got into Vietnam War, and Republicans don't want to be anti-war. So it's like, anyway, it's very good. David Halberstam's, you know, a great, exceptional storyteller and reporter, and I'm enjoying it so far.
Right on.
I have one last addendum. I watched, after your recommendation about Fargo.
Oh, yes!
I was stuck in Florida, and I found the first season of Fargo on Hulu, and I watched entire first season of Fargo, loved it, absolutely loved it, and I, one of the best television shows ever, bar none. Martin Freeman's great. Oh, geez. Billy Bob Thornton's great. I told our friend Chris Kenner, said, hey, if you ever want to know what you would be like in an alternate universe where you're a hitman, this is you. And I loved it. And I'm like, all right, well, let's try this 1979 version. And can I tell you that, like, when you alluded to, like, something from that era and something from that age or some sort of effect or something like that.
We're in spoiler territory here, people, if you want to save yourself.
I'm going to tell you what I thought it was, is, like, sometimes in movies when they want to what's that?
Oh, I say, so there was a moment you're like, oh, this must be what they were talking about.
Oh, as I thought, but I'm like, I wonder if it's, and it was not this, thank God, is that, like, sometimes if you want to show that a movie's in the 60s or 70s, or let's say point out that a girl is European.
Oh, that they don't have their legs shaved?
Or there's some other feature that's excessively, I was like, the way you described it, whatever, was like, almost like, what is it, like a shot of, like, that, you know?
Oh, got it. Unkempt hair issues. Yes.
The way you guys described it almost felt like, is that what they're talking about?
Wow.
No, it's not.
Wow, yeah, way to go right there. Jeez.
Oh, jeez. Anyhow, season two, absolutely loved. Absolutely loved it. Kirsten Dunst is fantastic. Jesse Plemons is great. Ted Danson. It's when you watch an actor and you're like, you know, he looks like so-and-so, but who is that? And you're like, no, that's him. It's not Ted Danson, the sitcom actor. This is Ted Danson, the dramatic actor, which we don't see as much of, in a great role. Just Patrick Wilson's great. Just all around, really a phenomenal cast, really well done.
Let's just tip one little thing. It's not really much of a plot spoiler, but there was something that you were so excited about that you texted me while you were watching season two.
Okay. Uh, if you don't you shut off now, it's not a plot spoiler, but it is a cameo spoiler.
Yeah. All right. Three, two, one, and go.
So this takes place in 1979, and part of this involves it's an election year, and you have Ronald Reagan. It opens up with the great – there's a couple Ronald Reagan threads in there because it's leading into – this is going to be the Reagan decade. And we finally get to meet Ronald Reagan. As it starts off, you hear this speech, and it sounds a lot like Ronald Reagan. And then you look and you say, like, wow, that looks – that actor looks a lot like, oh my God, it's Bruce Campbell.
Yeah. I thought the two elements, and I understand it's like there's a little bit of a funhouse element to Fargo. I didn't see the point of having Ronald Reagan show up. I didn't see the point of Space Aliens showing up. I think it would have been just fine absent those bits. But again, who am I to criticize one of the greatest television shows of all time?
Well, you know that Bruce Campbell's had like a cameo in like every Coen Brothers movie some way.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know this.
He'll be like on the TV as in a soap opera or something like that. I don't know if there are any exceptions to that, but they try to work Bruce into their stuff somehow.
Which, by the way, I am hearing phenomenal things about Ash versus Evil Dead. I think that's one of the highest rated programs of the year, and one of the few that I haven't seen.
And real quick, to get back to Fargo, there are, you know, the show is very literary in its, you know. Reagan and Space Aliens, the entire series, I mean, the story is about all these characters and reacting to each other. But the larger canvas that it is painted on is this world that, like, in the late 70s, these characters believe that, like, something is missing. Something is damaged. We are in this, like, fall of Rome kind of moment. And, you know, the Space Aliens and Reagan specifically are these larger metaphors for like the far future and you know the person who is going to lead us, the morning in America, you know, kind of rhetoric that like, hey, listen, there's no problem that an American can't solve, which is, you know, he even tells one of the characters. So I think that's where that comes in, right? Is that there is this idea of like the past and the future, and those are big metaphors that kind of hammer that in.
Right on.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.